Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce on Noon Forum. We'll hear the keynote address from the Chamber of Commerce Young Professionals Summit. The guest speaker will be Ari Shapiro, co-host of National Public Radio's award-winning afternoon news magazine, All Things Considered. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, March 9, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is David Brown, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce.
Now let me introduce our keynote speaker, Ali Shapiro. So he is reported live from above the Arctic Circle and aboard Air Force One. He's covered wars in Iraq, Ukraine, and Israel. He's filed stories from five continents. He's the co-host of NPR's All Things Considered. Previously, he was NPR's international correspondent based in London. He was a White House correspondent during President Barack Obama's administration. He was NPR's justice correspondent for 5 years during George W. Bush's administration. He's received many honors, including the Columbia Journalism Review for his investigation into disability benefits for injured American vets, the American Bar Association Silver Gavel for exposing the failures of Louisiana's detention system after Hurricane Katrina. He was the first recipient of the American Judges Association American Gavel Award for his work on U.S. courts and the American justice system. And at age 25, Ari won the Daniel Shore Journalism Prize for an investigation of methamphetamine use and HIV transmission. Ari also sings, making a guest appearance with a little orchestra called Pink Martini. Maybe he'll do some singing for us today. I don't know. Let's find out. Help me give a warm welcome to Ari Shapiro.
Hi, everybody. I am Ari Shapiro, and you all look nothing like what I imagined either. As one of you recently noted on Twitter, it's true, dude is tall. I actually really wanted to be here when Pink Martini, the band that I sing with, performed in Omaha just a couple weeks ago. I hope some of you were there. I really wanted to make it. I asked my bosses at NPR, and they said, you've got to make a choice. You can't make two trips to Omaha in a month. And I just couldn't miss being here with all of you. So, but if there is one thing that performing with Pink Martini has taught me, it's that everyone has a better time when the audience has had a couple drinks. So I know there is a bar open just outside this room, and if you wish to quietly sneak out and refill your beverages, I will not only not be offended, I will be honored. So if you've ever heard me on NPR, you know that I'm all about fact-based reporting and truth, and fiction is not my thing. I'm not about alternative facts. I'm not about stories. So what I'm about to say is going to sound a little blasphemous. I want to sing the phrase, the praises of fiction. I know this is not politically correct right now. It does not feel like the right argument for the moment, perhaps, but hear me out. The truth is, when I was in college, I didn't major in political science or history or journalism. I didn't study Supreme Court opinions and the founding documents. I was an English major. I studied English majors, yes. There is life after English majorhood. English majordom, English majorness. This is why I have editors. So I studied like Chaucer and Milton and Shakespeare, and instead of writing my senior thesis about the Pentagon Papers, I wrote my senior thesis about the Gothic novel. Yes, Gothic novel. And the reason is I always found that fiction allowed me something that nonfiction did not, which is that stories let me see the world through someone else's eyes. Even someone who I might think I had nothing in common with, someone who I might not agree with at all. And for me, stories helped me make sense of the world that we all share with one another. And right now we live in this America that feels so divided between rural and urban, red state and blue state, Trump country, Clinton country. It feels like we live in these bubbles. And so I feel like one of the best things I can do as a person with a megaphone is find ways that help us relate to each other better and understand each other better and understand how much commonality there actually is between us. And I realize that I have a very, very big megaphone, but the truth is that everybody in this room also has a megaphone, all of different sizes, but everyone in this room has a megaphone. And so kind of what I want to talk about today is how I use my megaphone to draw those commonalities through stories and how you can all use your different megaphones in similar ways. And before I go further, I just want to pause on this notion that America is so divided, red, blue, rural, urban, Trump, Clinton, blah, 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 blah. I actually don't think that's as true as we're led to believe. Pollsters have shown that you can take three of the most controversial topics in American life today, abortion, guns, and immigration, and you can create centrist positions that a solid majority of Americans say they support. The problem is, today our politics does not really encourage elected officials to find that common ground. Our politics encourages elected officials to tell us a story about how different we are from one another and how divided we are from one another. And stories, as I'll explain, help not only inform our reality, but actually help shape our reality. So at this point in my career, it sort of feels like I've come full circle, because after I majored in English at Yale, I went into journalism and I sort of left fiction behind. And for 15 years, I covered wars and the White House and legal affairs. And now I've become the host of All Things Considered, which means in addition to interviewing the politicians and the generals and all the rest, I also get to interview the filmmakers and the artists and the novelists and the storytellers. And it has perhaps not surprised me that often I find those people shed more light on the world we live in today than the politicians and the generals do. Just about a week before President Obama left office, he gave an interview to the New York Times. That's not surprising. What is surprising is that this interview was not with the White House correspondent, it was not with the editorial board, it was not with one of the big columnists. It was with the New York Times book critic, Michiko Kakutani, who has won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism. She's no slouch. But he talked to her about the role that books played during his time in the White House. And he said, "I found myself better able to imagine what's going on in the lives of people throughout my presidency because of not just a specific novel, but the act of reading fiction. When events move so quickly and so much information is transmitted," he said, "reading helped him slow down and get perspective. It gave him the ability to get in someone else's shoes." So he said, for example, he reached for Shakespeare to understand how certain patterns repeat themselves and play themselves out between human beings. And he read the apocalyptic sci-fi epic, The Three-Body Problem, to put things in perspective, because he said, as tough as his negotiations with Congress were, at least aliens weren't invading. And he said, "When so much of our politics is trying to manage this clash of cultures brought about by globalization and technology and migration, the role of stories to unify as opposed to divide, to engage rather than marginalize, is more important than ever." And when I read that, I knew exactly what he was talking about. You know, the news helps me know what's happening in the world. Stories help me make sense of it and understand where I fit in it. So last year, I did this big 2-week reporting trip to India, looking at the impacts of climate change and what India was likely to do in the coming years. And I spent half my time on this trip in New Delhi, and I spent the other half of the trip in this area called the Sundarbans, which is one of the most extraordinary places I've ever seen. It's like this lattice work, almost like a patchwork quilt, these tendrils of mangrove islands where three major rivers converge and empty into the sea. And half the land disappears and reappears with the tides every day. And Bengal tigers live on these islands, swimming from one landmass to another, and people live sometimes in harmony, sometimes not, with these Bengal tigers. And one of the reasons I was so excited to go to the Sundarbans is that 10 years earlier, I had read a novel by the author Amitav Ghosh called The Hungry Tide that is set in the Sundarbans. And it describes the place and it describes the people. And this novel had been so vivid that it had literally lodged in my head for more than a decade. And so before I went on this trip, this is one of the privileges of being a host of All Things Considered, I got Amitav Ghosh into a studio, and I talked to him about this place. And it was this incredible convergence of a real-world story about climate change and culture and wild animals with disappearing habitat with fiction that had first illuminated this place for me. And then I went there, and I saw it for myself, and I met people who had been attacked by these tigers, and I saw villages that were being emptied out of people because their islands were being consumed by the rising tides. Even just in the last couple of weeks, I've interviewed a few authors for All Things Considered who I think tell us at least as much as any news story about the world that we live in. And I think their writings and my conversations with them show us not only the power of a story well told, but also what makes a story well told. So one of them was this Pulitzer Prize-winning author named Viet Thanh Nguyen. And he has this new book of short stories called The Refugees. Now, Viet Thanh Nguyen was himself a refugee. His family came over from Vietnam when he was 4 years old. And in this book of stories, each story is somebody with one foot in Vietnam and one foot in the United States. And so when I interviewed him, I said, you know, your writing is so connected to your real life experience. Why not just write memoir? And what he said to me was, I think what fiction and stories in general can do is they can magnify one person's experience or one person's imagination and transmit them to a much larger audience. He said that his experience as a refugee had made his life more difficult, but that also that difficulty was in some ways enriching. And tell me if any of you relate to this idea. He said, I wish everybody had a sense of what it was like to be an outsider, to be an other, to be able to look at themselves with what W.E.B. Du Bois called a sense of double consciousness, experiencing oneself from the inside, but also experiencing oneself as other people see you. Because that is partly what gives rise to compassion and to empathy, the sense that you are not always at the center of the universe. Anybody relate? The sense that you are not always at the center of the universe. That is the power of the story, to see the world through the eyes of someone else, someone who may be completely unlike you. After Viet Thanh Nguyen, I spoke with one of the great American writers of today, Joyce Carol Oates. She's now 78 years old. She's written dozens of novels. She's won piles of literary prizes. And her latest book is this 700-page tome. It's called A Book of American Martyrs. And Joyce Carol Oates is on Twitter all the time, and she's very, very open about her liberal politics. This book opens with a shooting on the steps of a women's health clinic. A man who believes he's an agent of God kills a doctor who performs abortions. And for more than 100 pages of this book, Joyce Carol Oates only shows us the world through the eyes of the gunman, Luther Dunphy. And she shows us his childhood, his church life, his marital struggles, his internal thoughts. It's as though she is forcing us to relate to this human as a full human, as not just a killer, not just an extremist, not just a crazy. And at the National Book Festival, Joyce Carol Oates said, I wouldn't write about people that I didn't like and respect. I think they're acting from their own idealism, which is in some cases extraordinarily courageous. She said, I'm very fascinated by that kind of strange, perhaps tragic courage. What an incredible act of empathy to be able to see the world through those eyes and show the world to her millions of readers through those eyes. Because I was an English major, I'm going to give you one more quick fiction example. which is a book by an author named Anuk Arad Pragasam, and yes, I said that name live on the radio. He's from Sri Lanka, and he wrote about the civil war in his home country. And there's one passage where he talks about a fly landing on a patient in a medical tent. And here's what he writes. They would fold back their wings so respectfully when they landed, bending their four back legs, lowering their bodies, and bowing down their heads, raising their two front legs up in front of their faces. They would wrap their little hands together silently, as if in fervent prayer, and only after several seconds of prostrating like this would they put their lips down reverently to the skin. I mean, this is more effective and powerful than any piece of war reporting that I have ever read, or for that matter, written, because I've been a war reporter. And I give you these examples not to hold an impromptu book club at the YP Summit, but to give you a sense of what I aspire to when I sit down to perform an act of journalism, and what I think we can all aspire to as we sit down to tell a story of one kind or another. And through my years of working as a journalist, I've found that this subject, war, is actually, for me, the most difficult to make relatable to an audience of mostly American listeners, because we may all know people who fought in Iraq or Afghanistan, we may even know people who fought in Vietnam, but that's something so, so far away. You know, war can be so big and so abstract and so unrelentingly bleak and sad that for us as an audience of people getting ready to go to work in the morning or picking up our kids from school or just driving home from the office, it is really hard to get that sense of how to relate. So in 2014, I moved to London to join NPR's international desk, and there was an exhibition to mark the 100th anniversary of World War I. The exhibition had the name Bloodstained Sands and Seas of Red, and it took that name from a line of a poem that a World War I soldier had written in his diary. And this exhibition was in the moat of the Tower of London. And it was a red ceramic poppy, one for each citizen of Britain or the British colonies who had been killed in the First World War. And so you imagine the moat of the Tower of London full of more than 800,000 red ceramic poppies, just undulating like a sea, like a crimson sea, almost a sea of blood. And there's actually a reason that the red poppy is the flower of remembrance in Europe. It's because in European soil, when the dirt is churned up, in the spring, the red poppy is the first wildflower that appears. And so you imagine, after the winter of fighting, where these young men had lain in the ground, the spring came, and these battlefields just became these seas of red poppies. So I stood there at the edge of the moat of the Tower of London, looking out at these 800,000 red ceramic poppies, thinking, how can you ever tell these stories in a relatable way? You know, it's so easy for us to think of war as a thing that happens to a different kind of person. You know, like we hear these stories of terrible things happening in faraway places, and we think, oh, that is terrible. But, you know, they are war people living in war places, so it really is a shame. But maybe if they didn't live in a war place, it's terrible to think, and yet it's so easy for us to sort of put people in a box, not see them as people like us, but just see them as, oh, well, you know, those are war people in war places. So during the height of the refugee crisis, when Syrians were fleeing the civil war from Syria through Turkey and crossing the Mediterranean Sea on these overcrowded rickety rafts to try to get to Greece and safety in Europe, I went to the city called Izmir on the coast of Greece. And it was such short planning that I had nothing but a plane ticket and a hotel room. I found my translator, my interpreter, on Instagram. Because it's true. When I got to Izmir, I posted a photo of the waterfront, and I was like, I've just arrived in Izmir, I'll be reporting on the Syrian refugee crisis. And somebody said, I can't believe you're in my hometown and I'm not there to greet you and take you out for tea or whatever. And I said, Do you by any chance know somebody who speaks English, Turkish, and Arabic who might be available to work with me? And she said, oh yeah, my roommate's Palestinian, speaks fluent Turkish and Arabic and English, and I'm sure he'd be happy to work with you. So this Palestinian computer software designer who had never worked with a journalist before and I teamed up and we're walking through Izmir and we find this neighborhood where it's just cardboard boxes all down the sidewalk and families sitting on the cardboard boxes. And you know, at this point, these are war people. You know, I have no connection to them. I have no apparent commonality with them. They look no different from anyone sitting on any street anywhere in the world. So the challenge is, how do you turn these anonymous war people in a war place into real humans like us with stories that we can relate to? So my interpreter and I kept walking through Izmir. And we found this place that, to call it a restaurant would be an overstatement. It was basically a kebab shop. It was called Elsa Vitamin Center, which I'm sure sounds better in Turkish. And outside of this little place, the owner had set up these folding tables with power strips, and he had posted the Wi-Fi login and password. And all of these Syrians were there charging their phones and using the Wi-Fi to Skype or FaceTime or WhatsApp with their families back home or maybe in Europe. And I found the owner, and I talked to him, and he told me that he would let people wash up in the restroom of his restaurant, and even though it wasn't technically legal, he would let women with young children sleep in his offices. And I said, why are you doing this? You know, you could charge people for the Wi-Fi. And he said, these are people running away from war. And if I put myself in their shoes, I would appreciate if someone would do the same for me. That act of, if I put myself in their shoes, was such a small thing and such an extraordinary thing. Elsewhere in the city, people were being charged $100 a night to sleep in a crowded, filthy hotel room, not including the cost of the shower. And this man made this gesture that I think, for me as a storyteller, as a journalist, is so effective for two reasons. First of all, you know, if you're getting ready to go to work in the morning or driving home and you hear this story, you can immediately relate. Your phone is on 8%, you need to charge it up, here's a power strip, right? Like, suddenly these aren't war people, these are like people with an iPhone battery that's on 3%, just like all of us. And the other reason that I think this is so effective goes back to something that I learned from Mr. Rogers, who you might all be too young to know. But when I was a kid, Mr. Rogers had a children's show on PBS. And one of the things he would talk about is that when bad things are happening, look for the helpers, he would say. And, you know, to find these moments when a person does a small good thing, it doesn't make the problem go away. It doesn't pretend that the tragedy doesn't exist. But it allows you into it with a little less ugh feeling. You know, it gives you a little bit of a reprieve. So while we were in Izmir, I ended up meeting this man named Munzer Omar. He was an English teacher in Syria, and he was making the journey to Greece. His wife and his child were still in Syria, and his wife was pregnant with his second child. And I followed him on the first leg of his journey. Then my colleague Joanna Kakissis met up with him in Greece, followed him into Serbia. Another colleague met up with him in Serbia and followed him to Germany. And actually, last week, Joanna Kakissis told me that his wife and now two children had just joined him in Germany. And there's this old line that's attributed to Joseph Stalin. The death of one man is a tragedy. The death of a million is a statistic. And so I think the challenge for anyone who wants to communicate a big idea, whether that is me talking about war or anyone talking about education or advertising or business, the challenge is, how do you tell a story about things that affect millions of people without it just sounding like a statistic? And so often the answer is, the way you tell a big story is by telling a small story. I relearned this lesson in Sarajevo. I went there to report on the 100th anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, which led to the start of World War I. And this is a city that just has layer upon layer upon layer of war. I mean, World War I, World War II, the Balkan conflict of the 1990s. My translator there, Nijara Amatasevich, told me that anyone over the age of 25 living in Sarajevo has PTSD left over from the siege in the 90s. And so she and I spent several days out reporting, and one day we came back to the building that I had rented an Airbnb apartment from, and it was this old building in the center of town, and when we walked into the entryway, there was this family making their way up the stairs. It was an adult man and woman, and then a very, very old woman in her 80s. And they were going slowly, slowly up the stairs. And they were speaking in a mix of Bosnian and Hebrew. And so I asked what they were doing there. And the old woman explained to me that she and her husband were born in these two buildings that faced each other. Her husband had since passed away. They both survived the Holocaust, resettled in Israel, and this was the first time that this old woman, Ella Pinto, had been back to Sarajevo. And she said she wanted to go, she had lost all of her immediate family in the Holocaust, and she said she wanted to go back to see her older relatives' graves, to see whether they were still intact after all of the violence and chaos in Sarajevo. And she said she went to visit her grandparents' graves, and they were still there. And she said she kissed the headstone, and in keeping with Jewish tradition, put a stone on the grave. And so I recorded the story, and I was sort of sitting stunned, and I saw that Ella Pinto and my translator, Nijara, were talking to each other in Bosnian very intensely. It wasn't like small talk. And so later that afternoon, Nijara and I were talking at a cafe, and I said, what were you talking about? And Nijara said, well, she asked me if I had lived through the siege. And I said, yes. She said, and did you also lose people who you loved? And I said, yes. And the old woman took Nijara's hands and said, people like us survived so that we could tell the story of what we lived through. Because those of us who have lived through war understand the power of peace. And now I would like to tell you that I took out my microphone and said, Nijara, will you tell me that on tape? She's actually a better journalist than I am. And she said, would you like to take out your microphone so I can say that on tape? So I did. And I put that on the radio. But no one in this room has ever, I assume, nobody in this room lived through World War II. Probably most of us have no more than a passing understanding of what happened in Sarajevo in the 90s. But this small human story, this individual human connection across generations reached not only those two women, but me, and I think everyone listening to the radio, and hopefully everyone in this room, in a way that hearing a big story about war doesn't. So the last war story I want to tell you is about a conflict that the U.S. is fighting right now. And while the other principles that I talked about are true, you know, zero in on relatable details, find the helpers, tell a big story by telling a small story, there's another principle, which is that nothing beats a good yarn. And so I was in northern Iraq, along the border with Syria, and I was visiting a village called Sununi that had just been reclaimed from ISIS. It used to have 150,000 people. By the time I was there, only 10,000 had returned. It had been reclaimed maybe a month earlier. And so it was mostly military people. The mayor was back. Families hadn't returned. It was a lot of single men. So my interpreter and I went and interviewed the mayor, and he said, there's something I want you to see. I'm going to send you out with an armed guard outside of the village. Just go along with this. So we trusted him, and we piled into this car, and we start driving, and the armed guy who's driving us is talking to my interpreter, and my interpreter's eyes get really wide, and he hears the name Qasem Shesho, and his jaw drops, and he explains to me that Qasem Shesho is this legendary fighter in the Kurdish culture who has fought every major battle since the 1970s, and he's taking us to this temple called Sharfuddin. The Yazidi religion is a minority in northern Iraq, and they've been targeted for extermination, most recently by ISIS, but many times before that. And Sharfuddin is one of the most sacred sites in the Yazidi religion. And so we arrive, and it's this beautiful stone temple made out of this sort of like golden yellow rock with these peacock sculptures on top and these stone spheres. And we meet this man, Qasim Shosho, and he has this thick black mustache. And he explains that when this area fell to ISIS, he was at this temple with 8 other fighters. And they decided they would rather die than see Sharfuddin fall. And they had little ammunition, almost no food, but they fought. And as implausible as this story seems, we know that ISIS destroyed every Yazidi and Christian site they could find, and yet Sharfuddin Temple remained intact. They took me out to the plaza and removed this stone that was covering a hole in the ground, and in the hole there was a big piece of ordnance that had not exploded. If it had exploded, it would have taken out a wall of the temple. And I leaned over it, and later people pointed out to me that that was probably not a good idea. But and later we checked with the Kurdish government, and they confirmed that, in fact, after they found out that these fighters were holding off ISIS at the Temple of Sharfuddin, they airdropped food and ammunition and more fighters. This is the kind of story that you hear in Hollywood or the Bible or, you know, like a Homeric epic. And nothing but nothing beats a great yarn. There is the reason these kinds of stories have been told from the beginning of time, because that will help you understand what is going on and see things through the eyes of these people in a way that few stories do. At the end of our conversation, I said to him, "What did you do when this area was finally liberated and you realized this long 4-month siege was over?" And he said, "We didn't celebrate. We just cried." So I spent a lot of time all over the world trying to tell stories that'll connect us to people on other continents, thousands and thousands of miles away. And today it feels more strongly than ever that the challenge is really for us to understand our own neighbors, for the Clinton voter to understand the Trump voter and vice versa. And so the week before the inauguration this year, I decided to take a road trip. I chartered a course through North Carolina and Virginia all the way up to Washington, D.C., and I wanted to pick these two states because I wanted two close swing states that went opposite directions. North Carolina just barely went for Trump. Virginia just barely went for Clinton. And I wanted to talk to people from all walks of life and hear their stories about their hopes and fears in the week leading up to the inauguration. So we started in Winston-Salem, and it was Martin Luther King Day. And we met an African-American couple that had just opened a grocery store and farm stand in their neighborhood. And they said, "We don't support Trump, but we want to focus on the good that we can do in our community and the change that we can make. And we can't do anything about who's in the White House. But we live in a food desert where there's no fresh produce for more than a mile in any direction. And that's something we can change. That's something we can affect. So that's where we're going to focus our efforts." And then we drove to Yadkin County, North Carolina, which went more strongly for Trump than any other North Carolina county. And I talked to this woman who told me that her health insurance bills had gone up $1,000 a month under Obamacare, and I asked what it was like when she found out that Trump had won, and she said, "You know, I wasn't alive at the end of World War II when they announced that we had defeated the Nazis, but that's how it felt to me." She said, "People drove around honking their horns, waving flags, going to the Mount Olympus Diner to share the gossip." So I thought, all right, I have to go to the Mount Olympus Diner, which was the local diner where everybody shows up. And so my producer and I, we each ordered a cup of coffee, and we sat down, and we talked to these two best friends, one Republican, one Democrat. And they said that they hang out here every morning, and the Republican says to the Democrat, "You're going to go to our president's inauguration?" And the Democrat says to the Republican, "You're going to go to our governor's inauguration?" Because in North Carolina, the Democratic governor won after a very, very tight race and a recount. And then they wouldn't let us pay for our coffee. And I just thought, this kind of America, where the Republican and the Democrat can joke with each other and give each other a hard time and insist on paying for the visitor's coffee, that America exists. And it's not an America that we hear enough about. So the trip took us through a military base, and we met DACA students and went to a women's health clinic. And the last leg of our journey, we went to Liberty University. It's founded by Jerry Falwell, conservative Christian college in Lynchburg, Virginia, where we met up with a group of college students that were caravanning to the Trump inauguration. And for many of them, it was the first time they had voted. They were all Trump fans. And one of them told me that when she got to Washington, D.C. during our drive and saw the Washington Monument on the horizon, she got goosebumps. And that was Thursday afternoon. And then Friday morning, the day of the inauguration, we met them way before dawn in the suburb hotel where they were staying. And we were taking the train into town with them. And one of them said to me, he quoted that line, "All that is necessary for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing." And I said to him, "You know, at the Women's March tomorrow, there are probably going to be people marching with that exact quote on their sign who have very different political views from you." And he said to me, "Yeah, that's what's great about America." And frankly, I think he was right. During this period from the election to the inauguration, something interesting happened on the Amazon bestseller books list. It became a sort of barometer of national sentiment. Right after the election, the book Hillbilly Elegy hit number one on the Amazon bestseller list. This is a memoir by the author J.D. Vance about a struggling poor part of Ohio, people just barely getting by. And I think it hit number one because people in blue states were trying to understand another part of America, to try to see their country through the eyes of someone else. And then, shortly after the election, when President-elect Trump picked a fight with Congressman John Lewis, the civil rights hero, the graphic novel March about John Lewis climbed the bestseller list. Again, people using books to understand what was happening in real life. And then, right after the election, the George Orwell novel 1984 hit number one. Which is just incredible when you consider that this book was published in 1949. George Orwell didn't know what a computer was. He certainly didn't know what Twitter was. And yet, people found something in this work of fiction more than half a century old that helped them understand the moment we live in now. So, why am I telling you all this? I mean, I assume most of you are not planning to write the great American novel, although if you are, I encourage and support and applaud you. But every one of us has the power of a storyteller. You know? Snapchat calls its feed Stories. Instagram just introduced Stories, which admittedly are ripping off Snapchat, but that's a different lecture. Right now, some of you who might be a little bored have your phones under the table scrolling through Stories. And with one eye and one ear, the other hopefully trained on me up here, you're deciding what stories to tell, what stories to share, what stories to favorite, what stories to save, what stories to like, what stories to broadcast with your megaphone to a larger audience of those of us who consume stories every day. And those decisions shape our understanding of the world we live in, our understanding of the country we live in, our understanding of our communities and our neighbors. Do we tell the story of the man offering free Wi-Fi to help people? Or do we tell the story of the man who is charging $100 a night for a crowded room, not including a shower? Or do we ignore both of them and share a cat video? Do we portray America as deeply divided or as a place where we can actually find common ground on some of the most difficult issues that face us as a country? This is a tremendous power to choose which stories to tell. It is a power that we all have. And to quote the great philosopher Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. I have a friend in Washington, D.C. named James Alefantis, and he owns a pizza restaurant called Comet Ping Pong. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because Comet Ping Pong briefly entered national news because it was the focus of a conspiracy theory called Pizzagate. Somebody on a Reddit thread dreamed up a story in which my friend's pizza restaurant was the center of a child sex trafficking ring that was led by Hillary Clinton and her campaign chairman, John Podesta. It would be funny if the results were not so serious. My friend was not only found out about this when the worst kind of verbal abuse started showing up in his social media feeds, and then it extended to the dishwashers and the servers and the cooks who worked at his restaurant. And then the photos of the dishwashers and the cooks and the servers' kids that they had posted on social media started showing up in these conspiracy theories. And then one day, a North Carolina man decided to drive up and investigate this for himself. And he showed up at my friend's pizza restaurant and fired a couple rounds, and thank God nobody was hurt. And he was arrested. But this is the power of a story. The power to do good or the power to do harm. I began by talking about a few fiction books that I had read for work and interviewed the authors. And I want to wrap up by talking about a work of nonfiction. It's by an Israeli author. His name is Yuval Noah Harari. His first book, called Sapiens, got tons of attention from Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates and Barack Obama. And he just released this new book called Homo Deus. And one of the things that he argues in Homo Deus is that stories are what make our species different from any other species on the planet. And he defines stories very broadly. For example, he says that a dollar bill is a story. It's a story that we all share. He says, a chimpanzee would never trade a banana for a green rectangle of paper. Chimpanzee might trade a banana for a coconut, but it's only because we all agree on the story of money that we will willingly trade a banana for a green piece of paper. He says that most of the great acts of human cooperation throughout history are because we all agreed to share the same story. Cathedrals were built because we agreed on the same story about God. The Great Wall of China was built because people agreed on the story that the two of us are different from the two of them. He writes, no other animal can stand up to us, not because they lack a soul or a mind, but because they lack the necessary imagination. Lions can run, jump, claw, and bite, yet they cannot open a bank account or file a lawsuit. And in the 21st century, a banker who knows how to file a lawsuit is far more powerful than the most ferocious lion in the savannah. Each one of us can make the choice of whether we will live in a world of cynicism or a world of sincerity. We can choose to feed the world more snark or more reasons to be hopeful. We can choose to tell stories that help each other, or we can choose to use each other as a means to get ahead and ladders to climb. And, you know, the truth is, we live in all of these worlds at the same time. Shakespeare knew that in comedies, people die. And in tragedy, there are moments of hilarious humor. This is what life is made of, you know? Our Instagram feed may be all weddings and vacations and cappuccino art and lovely brunches. And life is all of those things. And also, life is hardship and war and sickness and death. And I sometimes wonder that if we talk too much about the good stuff, when we only share the positive news, do we lead people to believe that the bad stuff only ever happens to them? That when they've lost, nobody else understands what that feels like. That the hard times are something no one else goes through. The death rate, for the foreseeable future anyway, is one per person. It's true. I'm not even a scientist. You know, I've interviewed more people than I can count. And the truth is, it is all part of the fabric. The glorious and the grotesque, the beautiful and the boring. The stories that we tell can illuminate that or obscure it. They can connect us to one another or put up walls between ourselves and the people around us. We every day can choose to tell stories that will make people want to get up out of bed or pull the cover back over our heads and hide. We can relate to one another, or we can hold each other at arm's length. And I hope that you will all make the choice to connect. Thank you so much for having me, and enjoy the rest of the summit. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce on Noon Forum. We've heard the keynote address from the Chamber of Commerce Young Professionals Summit. The guest speaker was Ari Shapiro, co-host of National Public Radio's award-winning afternoon news magazine, All Things Considered. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, March 9, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Katie Rakwalik, Director of Special Events at the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.